Good afternoon. Muy buenas tardes. This is Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO, 102.7 FM, www.cooperadio.org, live on the internet. This is the Monday Brown Bagger. I'm Alfred Weber. And today we have two very distinguished guests, Dr. Judy Wood, a former professor of mechanical engineering, and John Hutchison, a Canadian experimental scientists, who will discuss how photographic and video evidence suggests that the World Trade Center towers were destroyed using directed energy weapons. Many of the observed effects resemble those seen in John Hutchison's scientific experiments. By way of background, I'd like to say that John Hutchison is a Canadian inventor and experimental scientist who has been working with field effects for almost 30 years. The Hutchison effect, for our listeners, is a collection of phenomena discovered by John Hutchison in 1979 during attempts to reproduce the works of Nikola Tesla. Hutchison used radio frequency and electrostatic sources. The Hutchison effect occurs in a volume of space where the beams intersect and intersphere. The results are levitation of heavy objects, fusion of dissimilar materials such as metal and wood, anomalous melting of metals without burning adjacent material, spontaneous fracturing of metals, and both temporary and permanent changes in the crystalline structure of physical properties of metal samples. And in January 2008, Dr. Wood, Judy Wood, posted a new study on her website, which is at drjudywood.com, which relates effects seen in the photographs taken before, during, and after the destruction of the World Trade Center Tower in those events that occurred in September 11, 2001. And we're very pleased to have with us here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, Dr. Judy Wood and, Canadian scientist John Hutchison. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, kind sir.
It's a real pleasure. And, I know, Judy, that you like to go through and explain these effects. I'd like to share with the listeners that I had the pleasure of attending one of your presentations in person in Madison, Wisconsin in August of 2007 at the 9/11 Scholars Conference. And it was like attending a college seminar because indeed you are a university professor. And so it's in that kind of a didactic atmosphere. And so what I'd like to do is those of you who are at home and have access to a computer, that you go to it and open up your computers and go to...
It's drjudywood.com. That's DRJUDYWOOD. .com, all one word. And that takes you to the homepage.
Great. And so we're at drjudywood.com. And from there, you're taking us to a particular article.
Correct. It's a few pictures down. You see a lot of pictures that I've used for each series. And you'll see one, the third major series. It's called Anomalies at the WTC and the Hutchison Effect. And that takes you, the title, if you click on the title, that'll take you to the index page. Or you can click on any of the pictures, and that'll take you to the specific page. And I'd like to start on page one.
Okay. So we're now here on page one. And I'm looking down. It says, Anomalies at the World Trade Center and the Hutchison Effect. Okay, take it away.
Well, it starts out with a video that John Hutchison recorded showing a boat sitting in water. Would you like to talk about that?
Well, I was doing a pre-testing experiment for Fox Television in our Epic Philadelphia experiment, and we were doing a model of a ship, and we found that the water started to levitate upward in waveforms, and sparks and lightning were coming off of the ship within the water container, which I put on a website for doing.
What caught my attention about it is the spontaneous combustion of the surface of the ship, and there's nothing there to burn. There's also no flame, no smoke coming off of the flame. It just dances around. And if you go down the page, there's various descriptions of the Hutchison effect and literature you can read where there seems to be either lift or disruption. And if you scroll down to where it says lift, there's a video of a can that lifts off. And below that, we see pictures from the World Trade Center site with cars upside down. And what I found interesting is that the upside down cars are less disturbed. The ones that are right side up, toasted. What I mean by toasted is they're total. They're toast. They're history. Various parts just come apart. There's a fire truck without a drive shaft, a steering column. And if you go down to figure 8, there's an upside down car in the foreground that looks perfectly fine, except it's upside down. And there's trees in that picture that are fully covered with leaves. So how come the car is upside down while the trees are covered with leaves? Which is kind of an anomaly. So we have this lift effect that it appears. And then also there's some odd fires. You notice there's holes in windows, circular holes. The Millennium Hotel, they said, had some major damage. But if you look at the pictures right after 9/11, it doesn't look all that bad. There's a few holes in the windows. And right after Tower 2 went poof, I say went poof, it didn't collapse, it just turned into dust. The Millennium Hotel, which is diagonally across the street from the World Trade Center complex, is there with, there's, in the picture is a tree fully covered with leaves, people covered with dust. Nothing else, it's paper on the ground and dust. How does a building turn into paper and dust?
This is in figure
16.
16.
And I began looking at the Millennium Hotel and wondering how could you get these holes in the windows when the leaves weren't blown off the tree. And the front of the block adjacent to the Millennium is that police car that's upside down in figure 12. So you have cars upside down, trees covered with leaves, holes in windows, and there's few, if any, projectiles. And as I say, no stab wounds in the building that we see. There's nothing that seemed to have broken the windows. And in figure 19, if you click on that, it'll expand into a larger picture. And you can see that there's round holes in the windows. Oops. What I did there. And figure 20A, and there's some blow-ups in 20B and C, that's the World Financial Center building 2. And you notice all the windows just about and the lower portion are missing. Why are the windows missing? And there's no apparent damage to the facade of the building. Just windows missing. So the description that I read of the Hutchison effect, saying you either have either disruption or lift, I can see that. that phenomena in what I see at the World Trade Center. Kind of interesting. And one explanation is that it has to do with the Casimir force. That's the force that holds the molecules together. If you could reverse that, they would repel each other. And what actually first brought me to the Hutchison effect was looking at the towers exploding, or whatever they're doing, and it reminded me of water turning into steam. When water turns into steam, it expands in volume by a factor of 1,600 times. And it looked like the material of the building was suddenly, every molecule was repelling itself into a larger volume. The steel that was flying through the air was shooting out into a dust cloud. And very little steel hit the ground. It all turned into dust. So this is one explanation that makes sense.
So what you're saying, just to restate it, is that you went back to the event and you collected a sample of photos and you reframed them and you looked at them from a different perspective and said, gee, looking at these effects, it looks like these effects look more like the Hutchison effect than a typical explosion from thermite or from fire or from planes hitting a building or from any of the other conventional explanations.
Yes, actually what I did was look at what happened, look at the evidence. I didn't concern myself with an explanation for how it happened.
I see.
Just looking at all the photographs and categorizing the different phenomena. And the one that really caught my attention was that the building looked like it, like water when it turns into steam. It suddenly, all the molecules were repelling each other.
Right. So it's what you're saying is a change of state.
Yes. Yes.
There was a fundamental change of state. And you wanted to call it molecular dissociation, which is a change of state.
Yes.
Yeah.
In the DIRT series, which you can also get to from the main page, that's where I was looking at the nature of the dust. And what really hit me with that is the dust settles out of the air fairly quickly, upwind from the World Trade Center. You have a clear blue sky, and you have dust settling out on the ground. And then pretty soon you notice this very fine powder rising up. That fine powder could not have settled out of the air that quickly. What it tells me is that coarse dust landed and continued to break down into finer dust and finer dust, which means that the molecules had to be repelling each other, continuing to break down.
Right.
And when I discovered this article on John's blog about the Casimir force, wow, that was the first time I saw an explanation that made sense to it all.
John, how do you interpret what Judy just described herself discovering? How do you see your work fitting into this?
Well, under observations over many years of my work, there's similarities to Judy's observations where we have metal samples that will turn white or be basically turned into like a puff of steam over many, many years. It's been documented either by the U.S. government or Canadian government or by other aerospace firms. So there are, what she's presenting to me, I can see it on a smaller scale on my work, and it is intriguing. I mean, I understand engineering myself, and what goes on, The idea of all that white dust in that is quite intriguing. The water, the cold, fires, which we experienced so many times in these tests. Plus the fact we were working with black ops, with the government, and my boss has said, well, we gave it away to him way back in 1993. You know, I understand what directed weapons can do. I have many, many cubic yards of documents on this, what they were working on during the Star Wars program. It was incredible amounts of unique things and very exotic things that they can do. They can manufacture antimatter. They can use particle beams, EMP weapons, rail guns, trillion watt laser pulse units. That's it. And it's very interesting stuff. So he's correlating what I'm doing. That's an interesting. What raises one big question: who slammed all of this into dust?
I mean, who were the actors?
Who were the actors in this?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, on conventional news, okay, it's been brought up a few times way back to me in the 80s, where there was concern of these cold hole explosions in the atmosphere, and nobody knew where this was coming from. That there was these huge, gigantic radio clouds being formed in the atmosphere. And this is unconventional news. And it was brought to my attention that Tom Bearden, Lieutenant Colonel Tom Bearden, who worked at Redstone Nuclear Labs, made an explanation on it. But much later on, the U.S. Army intelligence people would use Geiger counters to detect scalar waves that were formed in my experiments, as well as some other testing. So, coming around, yet again, they were concerned that the Soviets had this technology already. And then jumping ahead a number of years when they invaded Iraq, that the Soviets moved into Iraq, this on CNN news, regular news, came in and were taking out all the information on scalar weapons. Which I thought kind of fascinating. And that was mainstream news media. Briefly, short mentions of it, and then it quietly disappeared very fast. So the question is, who? Was it somebody in the radio that orchestrated this whole entire thing? It was something to deal in let's say, in the space program, in the old Star Wars program. Because the interesting aspect of all this stuff is, contrary to what others say, that there's very little energy needed to do this kind of thing.
Oh, so there's very little energy
very small
to do this.
Please note that in 1900, Nikola Tesla also blew up the Colorado Springs power station at a distance of 25 miles. Documented. And he prayed to them that we'll send engineers to you to repair the substation to supply us power again. So that's extremely well documented. And yet again, going back in history in New York, Tesla had a small device that would create major earthquakes in that city with a handheld device that when the police entered his apartment found that Tesla was trying to dislodge the thing with a sledgehammer. Fact. Documented in history.
Okay, so let's take that question of who there's, which is sort of lodged with a question of cui bono, who benefits in a certain way, and put that on hold, and we'll come back and address that question. But let's go back to the science here. That's sort of the political science of it.
Right.
and let's go back to the science here discover more of the anomalies at the World Trade Center that can begin to uncover the cui bono.
Okay, if we look further down that page at figures, 35 and 36 are what happened to the water around the boat. The water was getting levitated, and then it seems like the water was getting pulled into smaller and smaller bits until it looks like foam. And then looking at the videos in figure 37 and 39, there's still shots on either side in figure 38 and 40. But the one in the middle is keeps replaying over and over again, showing the tower turning into dust. It's like, I call it the Alka-Seltzer effect. It just foams out. Completely turns to dust. Like the molecules get pulled apart further and further. And very few solid pieces hit the ground.
Now, would you say, looking at this, and this again is figure 39 on page 1 of the article, Anomalies at the World Trade Center and the Hutchinson Effect. And here, it's the Alka-Seltzer effect. Now, let me ask a question. Do you think that the entire mass of the building is contained within that dust cloud? Or has the mass of the building disappeared into those nanoparticles you were talking about?
I think the dust is breaking down. Some breaks down faster than others, but within a very short amount of time. And if folks look from my homepage, there's the billiard ball example, which is something I did several years ago with looking at the timing effect. If you stood at the top of one of the towers and dropped a bowling ball over the edge, in a vacuum, no air resistance, it would take 9.22 seconds. So let's assume around 9.5 seconds if you had air resistance. The ground shook for 8 seconds when Tower 1 went away. In other words, there was not enough time for the building to hit the ground. And you look at this dust, you say, okay, that didn't make a thud when it hit. So if the building, you know, whatever is happening to it is just happening for 8 seconds and the building's completely turned to dust, that would be consistent with the seismograph. And even NIST said in one of their meetings that the seismographic signal and the seismographic effect was sort of minor. It was not significant in order to cause damage to the understructure of Manhattan. So how can you have a 500,000-ton building slam against the ground and not cause a significant seismic effect if it turns to dust before it hits the ground?
Right. Now, NIST, of course, just for the listeners, is the National
Institute of Standards and Technology.
And you have a very important legal proceeding with NIST, correct?
Well, with NIST and the NIST and their contractors, I brought to their attention errors in their report that they issued the fall of 2005 and have filed a QTAM case with the contractors as to having committed fraud. If they were to find out what happened to the World Trade Center, and there are manufacturers of directed energy weapons, I think there's a conflict of interest. So we have sort of the fox guarding the hen house.
Right.
They should be able to recognize the effects of directed energy weapons.
You mean NIST?
They're contractors.
Oh, they're contractors.
Okay. But like SAIC.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And ARA. Applied Research Associates,
yes.
And Science Applications International Corp.
Yes, okay.
Amongst other contractors who were responsible for looking at the remaining steel that had gone through some pretty strange bending and looked like it turned to jello.
Right.
And also there was strange effects with transmutation. If we look further down page 1 to figure 41, that's a car lot a few blocks from the towers where cars sort of instantly turn to rust. Tremendous amount of rust. And actually, figure 42 is on the NIST website where the beams are just solid rust. And how can a steel beam turn to rust instantly? Iron rusts fast. If you take an iron skillet, scrub it really clean, maybe use acetone in it, and stick it in your kitchen sink, put water in it, it's going to rust pretty quickly. But steel does not rust. Structural steel does not rust. Especially the kind they now make cars out of. Now, maybe we have steel turning into iron. If it gets dissociated from the carbon and other atoms that are added to it, maybe it's now iron. So the idea of transmutation caught my attention. Where I think of this molecular dissociation as sort of a musical chairs. The music plays and all the atoms get up and move around. Music stops and they need to sit down and some of them miss out on a chair.
I see. So what was iron, what was steel before becomes iron? Is that the implication?
Yes, at some amount of the material, what's left.
I see. So this is a form of alchemy, technical alchemy, in a way.
And John has also experienced that in his samples. Stainless steel rusting. That's shown in figure 46.
Right.
And the samples below that, figure 48 and 49. The battery's getting low on this computer. Yeah. you want to talk about figure 49?
Oh, my turn?
Sure.
Well, we're dealing here in metals that are high-grade stainless steel series that are slightly magnetic or non-magnetic stainless, very tough stuff that was subjected and turned to actually into rust during some of the experiments in the 1980s. So this is of great interest to the U.S. government and other scientists at that time, who would bring their own samples and then would classify that. These samples went under vigorous analysis at the Max Planck Institute in Germany, as well as the Toronto Labs with Hathaway and Company in Toronto, Canada, and also U.S. Army Intelligence and Los Alamos, plus many other national laboratories. But what we're having here is an effect that's happening on a large scale, very little power. And the very little power can be anywhere from 75 watts up in energy. But usually when you're viewing these samples, they'll start moving. Most of the time they'll levitate. Either water, plastic, steel, brass, aluminium. Sometimes a whole system will take off and hit the ceiling and vanish or disappear or be destroyed. But then we have translational movement where the whole containers are pulled along the floor. Like they're lost weight and they start floating away. That was captured actually on a non-classified tape by McDonnell Douglas Aerospace Corporation. Which I have a copy of that, luckily. But most of the time, with these kind of samples, they do lose. We found also that, we found with these samples too that they're progressively out of sync with time. They're going ahead in time. Fast decay of the materials, fast rusting effects. It's been documented by the Max Planck Institute, Fraunhofer National Laboratories in Germany, and actually Berlin Labs made those comments and wrote up reports on them.
Well, now that's very significant, because one of the major comments in fact, I spoke today to a professional electrical engineer who said, well, that's not possible because it would require an enormous amount of energy. That is, for a building like the World Trade Center Towers to be pooped, to use your term. And the fact that you're saying that these processes can take place with very little energy is really a very significant finding. And I wondered if you could explain why it is that these processes can take place with very little energy, because I think that's a key finding.
I think so too. It was really proven well with BCTV NewsHour, Tony Parsons, and the reporter at that time was Alan Edwards, when he accidentally cut the extension cord into the lab when we were doing a major test, which aired on the 6 o'clock news at that time. Now, what we're operating is keyways into perhaps a Casimir realm in the subatomic realm, where we have RF generating equipment, electrostatic generating equipment, along with weak nuclear forces, which are combining and linking up in time and space and opening up a gate so that the Casimir energy can flow in and do whatever energy is required to cause these effects, like taking bars and twisting them into knots. It's a key, using very little energy as a key to open up sort of a gateway where this energy can come in time and space and do whatever is needed.
Very interesting.
Very fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
It's one of the big issues with the SDA, Star Wars program, but they could use that too, those kind of principles, and then juice up the big, great big particle beam weapons. And I've seen them in the sub-basements in Nevada State University. These cannons, they look like cannons, and they're extremely well made. I would say they must have weighed many tons, and one of them was an ion cannon. And Dr. Rauscher showed me this ion cannon. He said, I'll show you a demonstration someday, but unfortunately that never happened. He should testify that this cannon existed. And I've seen others too.
So we're beginning to be able to prove means. We're just going to stop, take a break here just a moment. Welcome back. This is Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, www.cooperadio.org. We're with two very distinguished guests, Dr. Judy Wood, former professor of mechanical engineering and expert on the 9/11 event, and Canadian scientist, John Hutchison, discoverer of the Hutchison effect, and together, new discoveries are being made.
Mm-hmm.
Of the application of science to these events that will hopefully bring to light how these events occurred. Well, let's resume our conversation then.
I don't know if it's the exact same thing as the Hutchison effect, but what I've learned from this is that here is something that does the same thing that we see.
Yes.
So we know it's possible.
Right.
It's not a total mystery, and it takes very little energy. And one thing I noticed from looking through the transcripts that were available in the New York Times of the first responders that were taken soon after 9/11, quite a few of them talked about the cold dust cloud. That big dust cloud we saw rolling down the street was cooler than ambient temperature. Another thing we'll notice is after the dust cloud passed, we didn't have any toasted bodies, no cooked bodies. Matter of fact, we haven't seen any evidence of anybody being cooked, which was quite interesting. We see these toasted-looking vehicles, but no cooked bodies, and reports of cooler-than-ambient-temperature dust clouds. And when I first read that, I was wondering, could it be that the energy of the material was they pulled out of the material, and that's why the temperature dropped. Because that was used from, if something is ambient temperature and you remove some energy from it, it's going to drop in temperature.
Very interesting. So this is really following the physics of the event.
Just trying to think of what would cause this, you know, what we see or what is happening. The temperature drops in a material as it comes apart. What explanations are there for physically what's going on? And John, I believe you have some experience with things being colder.
Colder, and some of the samples, when we're experimenting with them after we shut down, we might go in and examine these samples. They seem to be colder. But what I think of, too, what's been brought up in the psychotronics black ops world is that that's made comment quite a number of times, has been if a woman sees her child being a car landing on her, she'll go and lift that car off with superhuman strength. But they estimate also that around her that the actual environment will drop a few degrees down, which has interested me. And I always seem to pigeonhole all these different things over the years from black ops, from different scientific explanations and experiments, which means there's a huge amount of energy supplied to the human body.
From somewhere.
And again, it goes back into the zero-point energy or quantum Casimir effect or other very unique situations.
Now, that's fascinating. That's really fascinating because that goes into the multidimensional aspects of the human body and its ability to draw on other dimensions of energy.
That's very true and proven a lot by scientists such as Robert Jahn at Princeton University, and has been a topic of late in the such topics as The Secret, and being proven out by scientists and presented on Discovery Channel, such as The Secret and Quantum Science and Quantum Physics. And I've witnessed this personally with doing experiments in The Secret kind of thing. Things will manifest in reality later on, meaning that there are interdimensional connections and strings that can be manipulated or for good or bad.
Very good. So, take us further along on the journey now through what happened at the site.
Well, I have more pictures that correlate. Further down page one, there's a section called Toasted Metal, and there's a hazmat truck parked out in front of what was WTC-6 that has holes in it. Right below that is a Red Bull can with a hole in it. So that's from John's lab. And it looks very similar. And I noted the toasted look around the hole, the brownish look. And if you look down to figure 60A, that's the hole in the street right outside of where Tower 2 was. And you see the aluminum cladding with that same toasted look. And it's kind of peeled open. So what would be causing the aluminum cladding at ground level to look toasted?
So you're comparing figure 58?
Yep.
And figure 61A.
Or 60A.
Yeah.
One's a close-up shot of it. That this aluminum kind of gets toasted. We could also go to the bottom of the page, and you can see where it says JJ4. That on that menu bar. I think that's the page. We'll look at some other interesting things I had noticed a year and a half ago when I was categorizing all of these phenomena. One was the peeling effect, where cars that don't have laminated doors appeared to be delaminating, splitting down the thickness of the doors or other parts of the metal. So at the top of that page, you have figure 120 and 121. There are vehicles with the split thickness look. If you look right below that, there's some of John's specimens that seem to split from the middle.
This is going on to the next page.
On page 4.
Page 4, oh, sorry.
So if you go to the menu at the very bottom of the page.
Oh, I see.
You can jump to page 4. All of the pages are interlinked. The other pages just have other phenomena that with comparisons. And if you look further down, it's interesting to see aluminum just splitting from the inside, just kind of exploding. And if you look at figure 125, 128, 127, where you have this bent aluminum bar that sort of exploded from the inside, and compare that with figure 74, 224, and 74E below that, they're of the World Trade Center towers, that look like they're exploding from the inside out.
Well, now, let me ask you a question, and it might seem like something that's totally off the wall, but I'll just ask it. I remember when I was at Stanford Research Institute, and Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff were, I was there at the same time as them, and they were doing their remote viewing, and their big claim to fame at the moment is that, at that time, is that they, were able to, draft papers that were accepted into the IEEE journal. It seems to me that you now have documentation that you could put together in papers that would be published by accepted journals such as the IEEE. I mean, you're dealing with comparisons between laboratory effects and field effects. Is this a course of action that you think would be useful, or?
Perhaps it's only so many hours in the day.
I see. I see what you're saying.
But it is intriguing, and I've put into these physical observations and noticing similarities, and that's where things are now. But it is pretty intriguing.
Yeah, because now it seems to me that in this paper you've achieved a new threshold, and that is to have what we could almost call a laboratory control.
Proof of concept.
Yeah, proof of concept. And that brings in a whole new standard to present a whole new standard of expression to the various audiences. I mean, there are so many audiences for this material, ranging from a public audience, a judicial audience, a legislative audience, a research audience, and it's just that the mind literally starts, gee, when are you guys going to make your first TV documentary? Is the first thing that comes to my mind.
Wow.
This, to me, there's a lot of compelling similarities.
Yeah.
Enough so that it's pretty convincing that some amazing technology was used.
Yes.
Something did this to the buildings.
Right.
It's an amazing technology. We don't know who did it or what exactly it was, but let's study it because we could use this technology for good things.
Yes. Indeed. That's a very profound statement. because that that statement, in fact, dovetails with the mission and the goals of a whole movement called the Disclosure Movement, which is that, and I think that John has touched on it, and that is that in the behind the sequestered projects of the Black Budget and other classified military intelligence projects, there are these advanced technologies which are being developed at taxpayer expense, which are for weapons applications, which could as easily be applied to new energy applications that would be to the benefit of the biosphere and to the benefit of humanity. And the object of the Disclosure Movement is to have these technologies, since they have been taxpayer funded, be brought into the public domain. So here I think there's a nexus between, at a public policy level, between this research. This research, I think, underscores the need for disclosure. Whatever technology did this should be disclosed. So this is I'm just sort of trying to underscore here the broad appeal that this research has. And I wondered if you could comment on that aspect of it.
Well, I think that I agree on that, my approach on all of this technology that I'm doing, and with a friend also who's well advanced in this area, we want to put it out into the news media, into an actual TV series called the Hutchison Effect TV series on Fox, one of the main networks, to present this out in a friendly way, that all these technologies and that the new generation of inventors, discoverers, will be motivated in creating this on their own. And that's for the benefit of the for the Earth, as well as the oceans, to bring Earth back into balance. Because the technology requires little energy to go on to transforming it into a massive effect. But also the Earth is extremely massive, the environment is extremely massive to try and correct the problems. A bit dangerous and risky, I would imagine, that is true. But if something is not done, Mother Nature has the ability to closing down all of this within a number of years. So it has to be handled by people who have positive intentions and not warlike intentions.
Right.
It's very difficult. Very tricky thing, but there's going to always be somebody wanting to use this stuff for evil, even in presenting it as a teaching item through the news media and television. There'd be always somebody wanting to try and use it for something bad.
If I can help think of clean energy, mm-hmm. cleaner than any other energy form we have right now, and it's abundant.
It's extremely abundant. And I was actually waiting for the Canadian Environment Protection Agency to supply us with money to go into immediate production of the zero-point energy power cells, which is similar in parallel to this kind of technology, that people could have their own power supplies to power their homes eventually. Because the military-industrial complex do have these units, and you use them, they call them battery-replacing units, and I know they exist. Seen diagrams of them. They're reconfirmed by the black ops people, but they're not in the public market.
Right. So here we have the example of this new energy technology that's used for, if in fact it's confirmed. Let's just say that we're following this model now, but here we have this new energy technology whose application has been for an act with extremely negative linkage effects.
Mm-hmm.
A global war on terror with at least several million lives lost to date in terms of Afghanistan. One quarter of the population of Afghanistan has been genocided since the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 under the pretext of 9/11. Over 1 million deaths in Iraq, plus 4 million population disrupted, not to count the genetic damage to the DNA and all of the birth defects from the depleted uranium the low-level nuclear war carried out against the population of Central Asia through the depleted uranium bombing of Afghanistan and Iraq and all the surrounding territories as the winds carry all that ionizing radiation. Plus, the implementation of a domestic police state, a global police state worldwide, through the various homeland security apparatuses implemented in the U.S., Canada, Europe. I mean, you can't even get on an airplane anymore. It used to be fun to fly.
Yes.
Now you're guilty just when you walk into an airport.
You're guilty, yes. And this, you know, this energy, as you say, it's the depleted uranium is being detected over now the UK.
Yeah, exactly.
That was broadcast a year and a half ago, I believe.
Yeah.
Take, for instance, there are patents on a free energy device that uses zero-point energy by Dr. Franklin Mead, 1996, December 31, where people could actually search online for that. But you may be in for a surprise because IBM has bought up all the patent rights to it. And it's a device that uses this energy. So what is IBM going to do with this? Much like the Juron Corporation bought up all the patents on telomerase, the anti-aging enzyme. Now you can join their little club for $25,000 for an anti-aging product. So it's really, really goes into twists and roads and avenues of verifiable facts. All this can be verified on the internet.
Yes, exactly. Judy, let's get back to our college lecture here, because this is what brought us here with the Hutchinson effect, and this is what's opening our eyes. So bring us back to the data.
Let's see. I think it's on page 2. I'm looking for the bent beams. The page 2 begins with the weird fires. And we see still pictures. If you look at, you know, the menus at the top or the bottom of the page, you can go between the various pages. So JJ2. And we have still pictures of the fire dancing up and down the boat. And we have pictures of the fires dancing up and down a car. Figures 78, 79, 80. What's interesting is all four of those pictures were taken within 1 minute. These are frames from a video.
This is, could be what? I'm sorry?
78, 79, 80.
78, 79, 80. Okay.
They're right below the still shots of the boat video.
Mm-hmm.
And we see a car in a parking lot with fire dancing around it, across it, behind it. I don't see any smoke coming from that fire. And the fire is moving quickly, just like with the boat. But what is interesting about this is these pictures were taken. When was 9:46? That was 15 minutes before Tower 2 went poof. It was after Tower 2 got its hole in it. So how did the airplane-shaped hole appearing in Tower 2 cause these cars to have this weird fire? These cars were basically at the base of, a block over from the base of Tower 2, along Liberty Street, near the Liberty West intersection. Pretty strange. And figures 73, 74, 75 are from a news video where we see this spontaneous combustion right down the street, just suddenly something poofing into fire. And figures below that, like 81, 82, we have firefighters walking through this fire, weird fire. The guy's not afraid to get his pants on fire. Is that fire hot? What firefighter would walk through fire? And then we have cars burning next to paper that's not burning. Some mighty weird fires. One interesting picture I call the Cheeto picture. There's one of the grapplers is picking up something that looks like it's glowing. If this is not a Photoshop picture, if this picture is for real, we know that that glowing thing cannot be that hot because the hydraulics are still working. And I have a chart in there from a mechanical engineering handbook showing the operating temperatures. For one thing, you'd have thermal expansion mismatch of the part that's sliding inside the other part, and it would seize up. You'd have a breaking of the seals of the hydraulics. Whatever way you look at it, the hydraulics are not working if they're picking up something hot. So why is this glowing? Also, why would they pick up something that's that hot? Are they carrying it to the dumpster? And let's see, I think it's page 3 that we want. And with, go to JJ3 if you can get to the bottom. And that should be the bent beams. We have a bunch of the fuming. And that fuming, yeah, page 3 shows the fuming that existed from the very beginning and is still continuing. In the area under where Building 4 was, when I was there a month ago, it was still fuming. This white stuff coming up out of the ground.
And you also mentioned that you got a cough.
Well, it's just a sore throat.
Yeah, a sore throat. A
very sore throat. It's as though you're catching a cold, that type of sore throat.
Yeah. So being in the proximity of Ground Zero at the World Trade Center,
You immediately get a sore throat.
Yeah, so there's some sort of chemical process or molecular process that's still occurring there.
Correct. I believe it's still breaking down. Whatever process was begun is still unraveling, and they haven't been able to stop it yet. And what I've noticed being at the site is that they bring in fresh new topsoil dirt, dump it on it, stir it around, haul it back out. Like they're trying to mop it up.
Well, are they not scheduled to commence construction on that site soon? Or?
They're a little bit behind. And what I have on this page 3, if you look down at figure 100, 101, and 102,
mm-hmm.
100, here they are digging in a ditch of water, and you have this fuming coming up, which is strange. Mm-hmm. And figure 101, you also have it. That's below right where Building 4 was. And the difference between figure 101 and 102 is striking. 101, we're about 4 stories below ground. 102, which was taken afterwards, which was taken a year later, there's dirt up to 1 story below ground level. So here they dig down, they're blasting away, and then they bring, it's clear that dirt was brought in. What are they doing hauling away dirt a year later at a higher elevation? And in an article, January 1st, they're talking about the fees being paid to Silverstein because they're late cleaning up the site. And they stated in there, as we got deeper, there were more rock that needed to be blasted and broken up. But here, later on, we see piles of dirt. That doesn't look like rock being blasted. The dirt is getting piled on top of what they dug.
Mm-hmm. Right. So now, in a way, the cover-up, literally, the physical cover-up is still continuing at the site.
And you still see the fuming.
And you still see the fuming. So this is, and so, in a way, the attack is still continuing. Because that process is still continuing.
And I believe that's got to be a health risk.
Yeah.
Thick is continuing.
Yes, and apparently I have the privilege of attending and speaking at the 9/11 anniversary conference this year, at September 11, 2007. And it was a wide range of speakers were there from the community, and the issue of the health risk to the New York community is very much front and center, and the resistance of government at all levels to make any sort of compensation to either first responders, to the residents, in that area, there's an enormous, and people who are residents or who were present in that area have and are exhibiting strange ailments, and there's a lot of illness associated with 9/11 that has been covered up and has not been dealt with.
There's firefighters I'm aware of, and first responders and EMT workers whose transcript I was reading through, mm-hmm. that were talking about these things happening on that day. And I understand now they're on disability, but right. being cut off of any medical help. So here they were used for being a first responder, and then they're thrown away. It just hurts me terribly.
Yeah.
And on this page, I have a picture of a traffic cop, the corner of Liberty and Church, wearing a rubber hazmat suit. This is this past fall. Does that fellow know what he's being subjected to?
Right.
Why is he wearing a yellow hazmat suit? It's a bright, sunny day. People in the background are wearing T-shirts.
Yeah.
And at the site, they're hosing down each other's boots, wearing yellow rubber suits.
Right.
There's something still going on there. I feel like saying, Houston, we have a problem. We need to address it instead of hiding it. What also seems to be happening around the eastern bathtub, not where the trade centers were, but where building 4 and 5 were, they're building a big concrete vault around that area. It goes like 10 stories deep. Pretty interesting.
We're now coming just to the waning minutes of this hour, which has gone by so quickly, because it's so fascinating. And it seems like officialdom is trying to bury this information and 9/11. Just this week, the Bush administration announced that it's trying to rush to judgment with a trial to bring up on the death penalty 6 individuals who are being held at the Guantanamo Bay prison, at least one of which has been tortured using waterboards on the grounds that, quote, he is the prime mover behind 9/11.
What evidence is there?
That he invented 9/11 and suggested it to bin Laden in 1996. So that the principal perpetrators, perhaps, are now trying to move to bury 9/11 from a legalistic standpoint. And I'm just wondering in these last few minutes where each of you, because you've developed such, or just beginning now to develop this compelling body dynamic breakthrough body of discovery. It's more than information. It's more than evidence. Evidence is discovery. And I'm wondering where you would like to take this.
I would like to see folks look at Ground Zero. Look at these images. See what they conclude. Is this a new technology? If it is, it's an amazing technology. And there are so many good things we can do with it. We shouldn't sweep it under the carpet. We should use it for good things. And I think that's, you can't really deny that something amazing took place that day. So why not study it?
John?
Yes, I'd like to see Judy get her answers on this, and that also that the reports that were classified on my work presented to the case too, especially from the Canadian government as well as U.S. government, all the audio tapes and videotapes, and Super 8 millimeter film presented as an evidence, perhaps, in doing that. So to make it more solid and strong case.
Excellent. Well, this hour has gone by so quickly. I hope that you'll come back and visit us again.
Oh, we would love to.
Oh, great.
Yes, of course.
And you can visit Dr. Judy Wood's website at
drjudywood.com.
And John, how can people stay in touch with your work?
I think they could go to http://johnkhutchison.blogspot.com. It's the safest site around. I'm in control of it. Or American Anti-Gravity, if you would like to.
From the top of my website, there's links to it.
Oh, good.
That helps. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, thank you both very, very much for being here.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO, 102.7 FM, www.cooperadio.org. This is the Monday Brown Bagger. I'm Alfred Weber. May you have a wonderful and miracle-filled day. Thank you.